keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side, keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our way, if we keep on the sunny side of life.
So welcome to the inaugural Export Finance Podcast. I say the Export Finance Podcast. There may be other Export Finance Podcasts out there, but we're going to assume this is the only one. We have a room that speaks to, we described in one word, which is diversity. So we have Gabby Buck, formerly with Barclays, now with GKB Ventures. I have Simon Jones, head of structured export finance EMEA for TD. We have Simon Sayer, global coordinator and export head of export finance EMEA for Deutsche Bank, and Richard Hodder, head of export finance EMEA at HSBC. So welcome, everyone. And as a starting point, I just wanted each of you to say how long you had been in the industry. So starting with Richard.
Hi, good morning, everybody. My name's Richard Hodder. I've been in the business for 19 years, working at HSBC, covering Middle East and Africa over that period.
Yeah, and Simon Sayer?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a sliding scale of dates that you could use here, but I think the right one to use would probably give me about 25 years in export finance.
Yeah, Gabby?
Yeah, I'm slightly longer. I'm at 26 years. Yeah.
26 years. And Simon Jones?
The best till last.
Yeah.
In January, I reached 29 years, but that's across four organisations, actually. So Barclays, ABN AMRO, ANZ, and now TD.
Excellent. So 99 years in total. So we do have a lot of experience here. So thank you all very much for coming. So just to give you an idea, we're looking to do these podcasts, regularly over the next few months. The idea is we will then do a live show, otherwise known as a panel, at our conference in Rome on the 9th and 10th of June. So the subject for this particular podcast is the role of export finance in a challenging economic environment. So I'd like to kick off with the first question, which is, are we heading into another downturn, and what impact is this having on volumes, on pricing and capacity? So who'd like to take that one on first?
Who's the most bearish?
I'll have a kick off. I wasn't quite sure what downturn might mean. Downturn to me, you think of recession. I think if you're talking about volatility and uncertainty, then yes, there is lots of uncertainty out there, and there's volatility creeping in to our particular market. But that volatility stems from, you've got depression in commodity prices, you've got much chat around China slowing down and not growing as much and therefore not buying as many commodities. You've got stress in most of the BRICS. Depression in oil being talked about in the medium term rather than in the short term. And all of this will cause much stress in the market. So, yes, I think as a backdrop, there is volatility and there is uncertainty, and thereby there is some stress creeping in, is my view.
Agree with all of that, but I am more bearish. To pick up Gabby's word, we're not heading into one; we're in one. This is a downturn. There's no doubt about that. We're in the midst of it already. Some countries are already in recession. Others are seeing hugely lower growth indices. Commodity prices are a part of this, but they're certainly not the only part of it. And there's a lot of political unrest around the globe, with many parts of the globe in political instability as well. So we're in the middle of that, and it's having an effect on the business, which is, of course, a downturn in the business as well. Investment tends to happen, particularly in our business, tends to happen when things are going the other way, things are improving. And we are a year or two into a downturn already, which means that the investment cycles have had chance to adjust accordingly. So projects are getting cancelled, delayed, put back, or just aren't starting. So I think we are, very much so, yeah, in the middle of one.
But I think that also gives rise to opportunities as well, particularly in the export finance market. We saw in the last crisis that the volume of the product being delivered globally was at its peak in 2010, 2011. So, with that with the current dynamic, there's opportunities there as well, and it's a question of just evolving the business model a little bit to make sure that, you know, there are new markets, potentially new clients coming onto the scene, which previously may not have looked at ECA. So I think, you know, from HSBC's perspective at the moment, we're incredibly busy at the moment. We're having a good first quarter to the year. The question is going to be, how will that translate through into the rest of the, you know, the latter half of the year? Where are the big deals that will come through in, you know, Q3, Q4? But at the moment, it's exceptionally busy, I think.
Yeah, I'm with Simon. I think it's I'm actually more bearish. I think over and above what Simon Jones has just said in terms of the economic indicators being down, one of the biggest concerns I personally have is the amount of debt that is out there in terms of both in the OECD and in the developing world. And I think if interest rates were to rise, I think the knock-on effect of that is going to be, it's going to be quite serious. I agree with Richard, though, that, you know, the flip side of all of that is that the export credit agency business will flourish. I think it's going to be a flight to quality in terms of making sure that what projects do happen, and there will be fewer, but what projects do happen will be requiring much greater support from the export credit agencies.
And so that counter-cyclical kind of nature of export
it's
finance.
The nature of the business.
Yeah.
That's the nature of that. You know, that's what the export credit agencies are there to do. Yeah.
There will be less, maybe less project finance business going on because of lack of investment, but the percentage of business being covered by agencies or with agency involvement will increase. I remember at the time of the last crisis, we'd just been through an absolutely phenomenal growth phase in the world economy. Liquidity was at its peak, you know, creeping up to 2006. Debt capital markets, syndicated loan market, buzzing. Single borrowers borrowing 9, 10, 11 billion per ticket in the syndicated loans market, not just the bond market. You think of those Russian borrowers. And what happened was those borrowers actually just turned into ECA borrowers. So the first 12 months of the crisis, you saw Rosneft, Gazprom, Lukoil all raising between them, I don't know, $10 billion worth of export credit, whereas they hadn't touched export credit for the previous 10 years. So I think it's just that the market moves, and I agree with Richard, you have to adapt and just be aware of where the opportunities are.
Yeah, and I think for following on from that comment, Simon, we are seeing borrowers that now that we've, particularly in the Middle East, who have not used ECA before, now coming into the market for the first time. So the comparisons from 6-7 years ago are repeating again at this point in time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd like to get onto sort of the new borrowers at some point. But just on that, I mean, sort of several of you have mentioned, you know, the last kind of, well, you know, the financial crisis, you know, 2008 you know, within that specifically, I guess the difference, it seems to me, from that to this is that commodity prices were obviously a lot higher around that time. Is that sort of going to have a, you know, how does that change things this time compared to last time?
Yeah, so that's a good point. I think going into the last financial crisis, it was off the back of unprecedented growth. It had been an extraordinarily benign period, and a lot of projects were being undertaken. Commodity prices were still very, very high. And what we've got to remember about the last financial crisis was it was specific to a particular sector, at least at its inception, and that was the banking sector. And it started off as a banking crisis, and the issues around the financial crisis were primarily liquidity and lack of availability of dollars in particular, but not just dollars. And so you had this huge swathe of projects requiring financing, but banks who were struggling to provide that financing. This time around, I think the downturn and what we're seeing in the market is much more fundamental. We are in technical recession in many countries. Commodity prices are low. China is down. There's political instability. There are many factors lined up to make this a more challenging environment than the financial crisis was. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to be as extreme, but the root causes are very, very different. And I think it means that the volumes of business available to us are probably going to be lower this time around than they were during the crisis, where it was a case of scrambling to find finance for the projects that were continuing to go ahead.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you look at commodity prices, you know, in many ways, that's a reflection of low GDP growth. You know, it's a very strong direct correlation. And clearly, low commodity prices will have a direct impact, and I think we've all seen it, in terms of fewer oil and gas projects going to market and mining projects. You know, it's going to be difficult for a new new asset to be explored in the mining industry. I think the double knock-on effect is for those countries who have historically been very dependent on the extractive industries for their FX position. And that means that their ability to spend on infrastructure, not necessarily in commodities, but just on, you know, whether it's social infrastructure or infrastructure for the country as a whole, will also be dampened. And I think that cycle, I don't think we've seen that second cycle yet. Yeah. But I think that's, you know, I'm foreseeing that to be happening in about 6 to 8 months. And, you know, so next year is going to be tougher than it is this year.
Mm. I agree with that, except I think, frankly, we're already seeing it. I think the indirect effect of low commodity prices is already being felt, for example, out of our African business.
Absolutely.
And out of our Middle East business as well, where we've seen, you know, oil-rich or commodity-rich countries being able to spend quite a lot on infrastructure, and that spend is slowing right down.
Yeah.
You know, either projects are being cancelled or just delayed, deprioritised. All the euphemisms, but they're not happening in the same volumes as they were before.
But projects are still happening, just that you need to identify which ones are key. Yeah. The second and third bucket of projects, they're the ones that get canned.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think in the case of Africa, you know, some African countries where, you know, they've really been hit by the low oil prices, you know, they've had to slash their budgets, you know, to you know, small percentages of what they were originally 2 years ago. So there, they've just, there have been a lot of projects have been outright cancelled and put on the back burner for, you know, 5-10 years. I think perhaps in the Middle East there's been a little bit the rush to cancel projects being a little bit slower, although we have seen some transactions you know, fall by the wayside. But I think the governments in the Middle East, they have a little bit more option in terms of how they want to finance their projects compared to some of the African countries. They had a greater depth of funding available to them, which enables them to go ahead with some of the infrastructure. And that's where ECA then plays a role, potentially, to finance those infrastructure transactions.
So we are still talking about an increase in, or a steady flow of ECA business, despite the lack of infrastructure growth in certain markets caused by the commodities.
Yeah, and well, I'm quite interested to see how, I mean, say, going off the questions on the sheet, but how you communicate that sort of internally within your institution, sort of a time where there's a demand, but there's a different type of demand. It's, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's important, you know, it's, you know, I guess it's, yeah, it's important to do the business at the moment, but it's going to be it's a different type of business. You know, what kind of conversations are you having internally? What kind of conversations would you have internally, I could say, if you weren't your own man?
Well, I think the smaller you are, the more nimble you are to I think being looking at the business going forward, it's about making sure that you are prioritising your assets, which are human and economic and balance sheet, on those projects which have a much higher degree of certainty of getting closed. So, you know, I think, you know, I'm looking amongst us here, you know, we're all quite nimble. We're working for organisations that give the individuals the ability to pick and choose. You know, I've never seen anybody in this market who is forced to look at a particular country only. And so, therefore, there's going to be winners and losers in this equation. You know, so, example, you know, even when you look across Africa, there are certain countries in Africa. You've been talking about Ethiopia the other week. You know, low oil price is a big boom for them. So it's really making sure that you are focusing your energy on those transactions, those countries where the opportunities arise, and you have to be nimble.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing, you know, how do you communicate that internally? There's a tremendous struggle going on in banking at the moment, which is all businesses are finding it difficult to generate the same levels of revenues as they have in the past, particularly for the same amounts of resources, the same amount of capital, same amount of RWA or for balance sheet. So the backdrop we have for our business is actually no different to what most other banking products face at the moment, for slightly different reasons. And One of the things I think is that none of us really appreciated the extent to which our business is correlated to an oil price and a high commodity price, you know, because of the direct projects we just discussed, because of the indirect ones too. But that affects so many other products within the bank too. So internal communication, I think people get that it's a difficult time. So then it becomes, well, how do you optimize what you do have? How do you optimize the resources you're using? Be very, very careful about deal selection. Pick those that have the best chances of going ahead. Focus your resources in countries which will be relative winners in the current environment.
Yeah, but, you know, I was looking at the data from TXF the other day in terms of the, you know, the volumes of business done. And what was quite surprising was the sheer increase in the developed world, where I would advocate that oil prices matter little in terms of the amount of ECA financing that is undertaken in those markets. So I just think it's an issue of, you know, we can't paint the whole world as being all dependent in terms of their budget spend on commodity price. Mm. And I think we just have to be, you know, if we're looking at the business and we are not pinned to a particular market or to a particular sector, then, you know, export credit agency businesses in banks generally have the flexibility to follow where the business is.
One thing I've seen, been not surprised, I guess, but is how a number of banks have been retreating from markets as well. So you asked about where banks will want to do business, and pre-crisis, everyone wanted to do business everywhere. Mm. You know, if you were an export credit bank, then you went where the business was, and if you had a strength in that market, fantastic. Today, we see a number of major international banks pulling back of their own volition from certain markets, trying to prioritise the markets they're in. And you saw a massive wave of that, particularly with people like the French banks in just around the Eurozone crisis, 2011-12, when they actually had to pull out physically from lots of countries. So you had lots of French banks pulling out from Asia, which is where I saw it, having been in Asia at the time, and they pulled out of Indonesia, pulled out of Vietnam. Some are gradually starting to go back, but I also hear stories about people's KYC issues now, and the regulation that's creeping in is making doing business into new markets even more problematical. So I think the landscape is changing as well. I'm not saying there's a massive shift and everyone's going to pull out of every market, but there is certainly a landscape shift, and people aren't doing what they did before. People aren't doing coal anymore, you know. So you had 50 banks doing coal 5 years ago, you've now got 10 banks doing coal.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm with my BBA hat on, we haven't touched on the regulatory impact. The regulatory impact having and altering the way that banks do business has impacted the ECA market very considerably. There are, I feel, a lot of unintended consequences that have impacted what is ECA. I don't think the regulation really meant for the export credit agency business and trade generally to be affected in the way that it has. And that, in my opinion, is a consequence that is going to continue for some time. And is the major driver, Simon, as to why you're seeing banks pull from certain markets.
I don't think the regulator actually understood or appreciated what a fundamental role export credit business played in what makes the world go round. It's small. If you compare it to the debt capital markets and the syndicated loan market, it's relatively small. However,
you say it's small, but for our 3 million, 4 million listeners out there, you know, sort of,
yeah. It's small relative to the depth of the capital markets. However, what the capital markets does is largely general corporate borrowing. What this does is makes things happen. This is buying strategic assets for people to make more money, and so you're funding fundamentally different types of assets. And
just
I think
real economy funding.
Yeah, yeah, and it always used to be a product that you could, you know, it was a way of going in and opening up new relationships in new markets, you know, taking limited credit risk, going in with a, you know, existing group clients, building a plant or a factory or some infrastructure in a new market. It was an easy way of getting into those, into new territories. I think, you know, following on from the comments that we've heard today, you know, that flexibility, I think, of banks going into new markets with the support of ECAs is now has reduced significantly on the back of, you know, reputational risk concerns, KYC issues. The banks don't want to have a general exposure to markets, even if the risk of the loan that they're providing is mitigated through an ECA policy. So that kind of idea that it was the new frontier, ECA could be used to develop new markets, I think that flexibility and that sort of element that was here 5-10 years ago has certainly disappeared.
Yeah, there's an irony somewhere, I think, sort of that I guess regulators have kind of in some way influenced business. I guess governments have influenced business, which means that governments then have to play a more proactive role in financing that business, sort of in some way, be it direct lending or subsidies or whatever else. I just wanted to get onto one of the points that sort of Gabby mentioned earlier, which was actually the increase of deals in developed countries. And I think sort of Richard, this is something that you've seen sort of specifically. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that and as a kind of lead into, you know, the new parties that are looking at export finance.
Yeah, and I think, you know, looking into on the developed market side, you know, last year I think the US again was the largest market, you know, which is, you know, a lot related to the shipping cruise industry business. But, you know, we are seeing increased volumes of inbound, you know, Category 1 market business. I suppose from, you know, the challenge from our department's perspective, we've now got to evolve to look at new borrowers within those markets. And our teams have traditionally all been set up so that we're marketing the emerging markets. We've got teams covering Africa, Middle East, Asia, Latin America. We're now having to reconfigure to make sure that we can look at these opportunistic deals. I don't think it's going to become, you know, that we're going to see repeat borrowers outside of the aviation and shipping industry. But are there going to be repeat borrowers there that are doing all their infrastructure financing through ECA? Probably not. But there are the selective infrastructure deals. You know, we've got a utility transaction in the UK at the moment that we're working on, where, you know, that the ECA product proved to be the most competitive source of funding available for that utility. So those kind of things.
And the ECA is from where?
It's from Europe as well.
From Europe as well, yeah.
But it's these kind of things where, you know, we don't have necessarily have the infrastructure set up to do the marketing of those utilities in the UK. It's not something that falls naturally into our remit, but we're having to educate new other colleagues and relationship managers within the organisation to go out and be actively marketing the product alongside the usual DCM.
Yeah, I mean, debt's debt, you know, at the end of the day, if an export credit agency backed financing facility provides longer, cheaper form of financing, greater flexibility, then, you know, a buyer will take it. And I have to admit, in my previous shop, we, you know, it was a trend we saw 7 or 8 years ago, and we had half the team were covering the developed market. We were doing transactions into the UK. Oddly enough, I was saying this to UK Export Finance, we were doing transactions into the UK on ECA-backed financing cheaper than a UK exporter could do to get it out. Yeah. Right?
But isn't this one of the great things that has happened to our business over the last 6, 7, 8 years post-crisis? We've just become so much more relevant to the clients of our institutions. Because we're now able to do not just emerging market business, but developed market business as well, Category 1 market, richer country business. And that process of getting our... You know, Richard, you're right. Our teams have never been set up towards developed market marketing, really. But the rest of the bank is. And there's endless bankers covering, you know, American clients and UK clients and European clients who, you know, are very, very keen to get to grips with the new product. And we start to use them more as a marketing tool than doing this ourselves. And I think that's just made us so much more relevant. It's given the business a higher profile.
See, I don't see it quite as new as you guys, because at my previous institutions, and particularly the ABN AMRO from 97, we always saw, as Gabby said, ECA debt as an alternative form of liquidity that had to be looked at. Every time you had a major capex spender on a project, you would look at the debt capital markets, the international capital markets, the domestic capital markets, the you know, the loan markets. You'd look at everything. And ECO, and you would put up a beauty parade and see what was the most efficient form of funding that particular project, whether it was in the emerging markets or not, to be perfectly honest. And we were also doing, we talked about UK projects. I mean, I remember we did our first wind farm into the UK in about 2002 for British Gas. We didn't tell anyone about it. I mean, that's why it hasn't been known, because if you found a niche, you kept quiet about it. So I think...
TXF exclusive, 14 years later.
Business into developed markets, I think, has been around a long time. In fact, I did an analysis in 2000 of the ABN AMRO portfolio, and 25% of the portfolio, and ABN AMRO was a major global export credit bank, 25% of it was into Category 1 markets. But that's not that difficult. If you think about some of the sectors, so aviation was always going into the Category 1 markets.
Right.
Shipping was always going into the Category 1 markets.
Yeah.
Telcos. We did deals into Spain, into Italy, on a routine basis, all the time. So Category 1 business isn't that new. And in the UK, and I've noticed all the UK deals have been done since then, and they lost these biomass transactions, and wind farms continue, and wind farms continue all over Europe, actually. So into Category 1 markets. Australia was the...
So really a Category 1 market?
Not steady, anymore.
Steady target. 2012, to follow Richard's US story, Australia was the largest recipient of export credit in 2012. Mm-hmm. Again, on the back of lots of resources projects. So you had iron ore, coal and oil and gas. You had the $20 billion Ichthys project, which obviously helped. But... Category 1 markets have a need as well. I mean, if you look what the basis of export credits are, I mean, okay, the export credit agencies are there to support exporters, is everyone's theory. They're also there, and why we are part of the real market, as a market gap filler. And you can't fund, you know, $50 billion worth of projects in 1 year in one country, even if it is Australia or the US, without some capacity fillers. And that's where export credit agencies have come in. And one of the biggest fillers has actually come from direct lending.
Mm.
So the North Asian agencies, China, Japan and Korea, put massive amounts of direct lending in. But that was fundamentally needed. It wasn't taking business away from the banks. That Ichthys project, I think, had $5 billion worth of direct lending. It needed it. It couldn't have happened without it. There was only $2 or $3 billion, was it, of commercial lending into that deal?
I think you're absolutely right about the direct lending, and one of your questions, which I've been hoping you were going to ask, but you're stubbornly refusing to, was whether ECAs can step up in the same way they did in the financial crisis last time. And while I think they can, I think their role will be different. And
they've already stepped up, actually.
The global financial crisis, it was all about liquidity.
Yep.
It was the problem that the banks did not have the money to lend to these projects, and the ECA stepped in. And I think much as it will be a fantastic headline to say the ECA's rescue the world a second time, I don't think it's going to happen quite like that this time around.
It doesn't need to. I think because actually the export credit agencies have actually put in place now, it took them a long time, some of them. Some of them reacted very, very quickly within a matter of months. You know, the Finns and the Swedes doubled the amount of funding through SEK and FEC, whatever was available at the time. COFAS did nothing and ECD did nothing and Hermes didn't think they had to do anything because they already had the fan brief market to support them. But the agencies around the periphery, like the Atradius and the ONDD, they quickly followed the securitization guarantee route.
Yeah.
And that's now come round. You've now got EKF, Finvera, even COFAS, SERV, ONDD, Atradius, all with the securitization guarantee. So that was a result of the crisis and the reaction to the crisis. It took some agencies longer, some governments, let's face it, read government for agencies, because that's the trouble.
Yeah.
Agencies then have to move the governments because they're all largely set up by acts of law in their own country, so it takes time to change things. But I think a lot of change has happened. So the recognition that direct lending, ECGD, the recognition that direct lending has to be part of the equation is now on the scene. It was there with the agencies in North Asia. US Exim had the product but never used it. Now it's definitely there, and I think as long as it's there, it can be used when time requires.
Yeah, I don't see it as a time issue though. I mean, I have to admit, I don't see direct lending as being a product which is there to fill a gap. For me, direct lending is, I think it's the wrong terminology. For me, Ellen is about sur rate. Yeah. Right. It's, and I think the sur rate, and there's a lot of agents here who don't like the sur rate, and there's questioning.
It's not in Asia, though.
Well, I'm just saying that the markets in Europe, direct lending is about sur, and borrowers, but there are certain aspects of the sur rate which is very attractive, which you can't get.
Gabby, you know, I'm really not sure about that. It's not just the sur, you know. There's a lot of direct lending done on a floating rate basis from, in particular, the Scandinavian direct lenders, so SEK and Finvera. UK has become very much about sur rate because it's the only way you can access it. But where you have a clear choice, I'm not sure it's just about the sur. I think it's about balance sheet as well.
Well, I think you're right in terms of the leverage ratio, which and again, with my BBA hat on here, I look at the market and I say there are one third max of the banks who are cognizant of the leverage ratio today. And one has to argue that, you know, an export credit facility isn't great when it fits in. You know, if a bank has got a return on leverage, you know, an ECA asset doesn't really work well. But there's two thirds of the bank, in my opinion, have got their heads in the sand, piling this stuff on, not realising that from a leverage perspective, this is going to bite them in the bum.
Yeah. And that's where the direct lending schemes are going to become increasingly important.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So can I just, moving back slightly in terms of, again, this idea that export finance is, you know, something that can be used, you know, to support developed market customers. And I can understand how that is very good for the banks because, you know, you have, you know, very good relationships with your customers in those markets. But what does that mean for the ECAs and I guess the modus operandi of an ECA? You know, I think sort of Simon Jones touched on it in terms of it should be about supporting exporters. You know, you've obviously had the whole situation with the US Exim reauthorization. And, you know, other ECAs have had some pressure at different points in time as well, ECGD amongst them. At what point can governments justify Germany to UK, you know, or wherever? You know, is that the kind of business that ECA should be doing, you know?
Undoubtedly, all right. I feel quite strongly about this. I think that if you look at today's economic situation, this is the first question that we started with. You know, in the developed world, GDP growth is not going to come out of your own domestic public sector spending. It's questionable as to whether the retail market, if you take the UK as an example, is going to fuel growth. We've got large amounts of private debt as well as public sector debt. So this country and many other countries around the world are going to be very keen to support their exporters as a way of creating economic prosperity going forward. And I think if you're an export credit agency, I can imagine that your agenda from your guardian angels are going to be grow your exports business, grow the number of exporters that we have, grow the volumes that are being exported out of the UK to or whichever country to XYZ. And it doesn't matter where XYZ is. It's about growing your domestic businesses through exports.
And this is perhaps where, and I completely agree with what Gabby's saying, and I firmly believe that, you know, category one to category one is exactly where the business is going to go. And we've done Switzerland into UK, Germany into Republic of Ireland, you know, and we see that trend will continue. But, you know, I suppose the one concern I have with doing this category one business is that the product is still a little bit clunky in terms of the way that the ECAs calculate their premium. They want to do this market-based test to make sure that they're not undercutting the commercial market. And I think that's where perhaps there needs to be a little bit further evolution in terms of making sure that you can persuade the ECAs to give you a premium quote in a timely manner so that you can go and deliver the pitch and say this is the pricing that is available on this transaction. rather than waiting or doing a 2-3 month piece of work with the export credit agencies to then come up with a number and say, this is the premium that applies for you.
I once waited a year for a premium. I have to admit, after a month, the buyer market just gave up. I was intrigued to see how long it would take.
And that is exactly the issue that we have, because Category 1 clients don't want to sit around. They don't generally want to sit around and wait for 3 months. You may be able to do that with a borrower in sub-Saharan Africa who, you know, this is their only choice. But when a Category 1 client is evaluating its alternatives, if it's going to take 3 months to come up with a final premium price, that is something that holds back, I think, the products in the Category 1 markets.
But, Dan, if I read your question correctly, where you're going with that, is your question, you know, is it right that resources should be used to finance borrowers in rich countries which have access to capital, debt, you know, balance sheet from a number of different sources, and should ECAs really be treading in that sort of space? And, you know, of course they should. And would we deprive somebody developing a project in an OECD Cat 1 country, a large investment, a large infrastructure investment or telco investment, from attractive medium long-term debt which is available to competitors? And don't let's forget, we're in a global marketplace, which is available to competitors in China or India or in Brazil or Russia. No, we shouldn't be doing that. You know, this should be a marketplace which is open for all. And I think it'd be very, very dangerous to say we should do less business in OECD Cat 1.
I agree.
Global marketplace.
I agree. Mm-hmm. And I'll go one step further. I think there's an economic war based on exports. And I think the competition between export credit agencies is much faster and more aggressive today than it ever has been. So going back to my main point, they just want to support their exporters. End of story.
Okay. Well, I mean, do you, following on from that, and yes, yeah, so Simon's point in particular, see, there has been, and I guess we'll get on to the point of export finance advocacy in a separate podcast, but the point, you know, there is a school of thought that has developed in the US, you know, that, you know, I guess it's quite extreme anti-government sentiment, but it's like, should the government be doing things that the private sector can do? And I guess, do we run the risk of, if export finance becomes something that is more done just Category 1, is someone just going to come and say along, it's like, well, wait a minute, and to Richard's point, maybe there are some inefficiencies in the way this is done. Like, why are we paying for this? Surely this can be done by private insurers. Or
they're not paying for it. That's the key aspect here. And I think that I cannot think of an export credit agency that doesn't create a net contribution to their exchequer. No, net. I'm looking to the rest of the guys here. They all are net contributors to their exchequer.
Currently.
Yeah. Now, I agree that they do have an open liability. Well, not open, but they have a liability, which is quite large. And hopefully they price that well. And hopefully, if there is a bad year, then, their guardian agents will look over the track record over the last 15, 20 years and say,
more diversified portfolio across Category 1 and Category 2 markets, works in their favour.
Could this be a dangerous line of argument, though? It's like, if you're setting up high expectations, you know, sort of US, sort of, what is it, 4 billion returns to the taxpayer.
Because there will always be in my opinion, that would only work if all of the export credit agencies fold. But so long as there's one, and you can just think of one out in Asia, that becomes still a very dominant export credit agency, then, you know, then there's competition, and so therefore they need to be backed by...
But why do you think it's happening? Why do you think it's happening? There must be a fundamental gap in the market for it to even start to be thought about. Tenor.
RWAs.
Okay. Tenor was the first one, because banks have a... Forget regulation and Basel III. Banks have a risk... aversion to tenor anyway. You know, the banks lines normally for banks are 1 year, for corporates 5 years, no matter where you are. You know, you go to Australia and the maximum tenor available in the bank market is 5 years. Well, you can't fund billions and billions of dollars worth of long-term projects on five-year money. So, yes, you could get them into the capital markets, hopefully. You know, capital markets for projects hasn't really taken off in the way that people thought it might take off in the 90s. We just concluded a telecoms deal into Canada. The borrower maxed out what it could in the commercial market, and the remaining 50% came from agency money. This is a developed market, but one of the most developed markets in the world. Sometimes either the tenor or the credit risk, there just isn't enough appetite in the commercial markets. And with increased bank regulation, it's driving banks away from their domestic markets as well, from doing things. Mm. You know, the regulation is causing some of the problem.
Mm. Yeah, if you look at what happened at US Exim, I think that was just a perfect storm at a time where you had so many things that created that. I can't see that happening again. Given that where Donald Trump is at this moment in time, one never knows what could be happening.
I think you could have the Exim offices massively upgraded with red marble everywhere and waterfalls in it. Sort of.
But I think though, at the end of the day, the agencies, you know, let's bear in mind that they've been around since 1919. So, you know, we're nearly 100, actually, it's 97 years, I think. Yeah, 97 years that they've been around now.
So this room just...
That's why I bring the two together. Yeah.
Simon Jones just covers it.
And my viewpoint is they're going to be around for another 97 years. Right?
But part of Exim's reauthorisation in actually the actual wording, you know, there is a statement there saying that Exim should work with other OECD agencies to bring agencies to a close within, I think, 10 years.
That's been in there before, right?
It means absolutely nothing.
Obviously conscious of time, but one sort of, you know, getting back to sort of, you know, the initial topic of discussion and particularly sort of some of those opportunities that could arise through this time. We've talked a lot about developed country borrowers, but also I think something you alluded to before, Richard, is that maybe you're seeing some interest from clients, you know, in different parts of the world that have, you know, obviously not always necessarily needed export finance to the same extent, that are looking at that, and maybe you can talk about that kind of client as well.
Yeah, in terms of some of the new names that we're seeing borrowers perhaps in the Middle East that we would never have expected coming out to look at ECA. So, you know, Kuwait, for example, a market where ECA borrowing or borrowing full stop has been a bit of an anathema. So, these are the kind of names where there are opportunities where there's, you know, suddenly there's pressure for these companies or state-owned companies to go out and finance their infrastructure. So there's a bit of a learning curve there, new experience, taking new names around agencies to try and explain the process and what is available if they want to put these multi-billion-dollar projects to bed. So those are where we see selective opportunities going forward in those kind of regions, where you can actually directly link the downturn in the oil price to the fact that borrower has gone out to have to look at an ECA solution for an existing transaction. So we're seeing it there. Again, Saudi, I think we're going to see more and more borrowers coming back and more transactions being done with ECA support.
Yeah. I think we're seeing, I know we sit on the periphery of the market, but in discussion with banks like HSBC and other major players in the Middle East, is... because of the oil price. It almost looks, perception-wise, if the Saudi government is telling the state-owned companies to go out and borrow because that's a way of getting US dollars and debt into the country.
Great. Well, thank you very much, all of you, for schlepping down to Lab Studios in Clapham North for this, in, you know, very glamorous environment for everyone. We will be doing this again, say, you know, on pretty much a monthly basis. We're, you know, there was a lot that we got through here, a lot more I'd like to get through in terms of topics, you know, for the future. I'd like to discuss, that role of bank, the impact of regulation, export finance advocacy, and also sort of the role of private insurance in all of this as well. And we'll save that for other podcasts. So without further ado, just a massive thank you to Gabby Buck, Simon Jones, Simon Sayer and Richard Hodder. Thank you very much.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help.